Einstein was right. This could be the world Holocaust that could send us back to the Stone Age.
A certain number, and a large number, of U.S. troops that have been docked off the Mediterranean coast of Turkey have unloaded.
When the question is asked the right way, meaning if it's asked about heavy civilian casualties, the people say no to this war.
George Bush himself said that if he were to be influenced by the will of the people as expressed in the protests on February 15th, then he wouldn't be doing his job as a democratically elected president.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, March 6, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A U.S.-led war against Iraq launched without United Nations authorization would be seen by many nations and legal experts as a violation of international law. That is one of several reasons the United States is working so hard to secure a new U.N. Security Council resolution authorizing a war. However, President Bush has made it clear he would feel free to launch the war anyway if it proves impossible to win such a vote. President Bush would lose narrowly to a Democratic Party candidate if the U.S. presidential election were held now because of concerns about possible war and the economy. That's according to an opinion poll published today. The February 26, March 3 nationwide survey of U.S. voters by Hamden, Connecticut-based Quinnipiac University found that by a 48% to 44% margin, voters would pick the as-yet-unknown candidate out of nine Democrats running over the Republican incumbent. The survey of 1,232 voters had a margin of error of plus or minus 2.8%. A recent article in The Independent, a mainstream British newspaper, states that the U.S. is preparing to use toxic gases in Iraq. According to The Independent, the Pentagon is preparing to use toxic riot control agents, CS gas, and pepper spray. Use of such agents would be in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, which bans these agents due to the risk of triggering an escalation of full chemical warfare. The ban in warfare applies even though the gases can be used in civil disturbances at home. Last year, 120 hostages in a Moscow theater siege were killed with calmative gases, those which may be employed by the U.S. in Iraq. The Independent newspaper reports that the U.S. Marine Corps confirmed 2 weeks ago that CS gas and pepper spray had already been shipped off to the Gulf. In Turkey, U.S. troops are reportedly deploying in Ankara. We go now to correspondent Aaron Glantz for a report.
You know, Verna, it's difficult to tell exactly what is happening, but one thing that is clear is that a certain number, and a large number, of U.S. troops that have been docked off the Mediterranean coast of Turkey have unloaded onto Turkish land. We see pictures on the television of large convoys of troops and armed personnel carriers unloading off of these docks, headed towards one base, the Incirlik military base in the west of Turkey, which is used to bomb Iraq on a regular basis as part of the no-fly zones, and another one, a Turkish base close to the Iraqi border. This coming a day after the head of the Turkish military, General Hilmi Özkök, has announced his support for the war, and although he said that he would recognize the will of the parliament, which had voted no against the war, today what he said is that this troop deployment is acceptable because it comes under a previous statement by the parliament which authorized the use of U.S. military forces to renovate Turkish bases, and U.S. military engineers have been on Turkish land for some time making these renovations, making the bases ready for American troops. But these troops that had been docked off the coast of Turkey had been waiting for authorization from the Turkish parliament. On Saturday, the Turkish parliament said no, but the Turkish parliament has not yet changed its mind, and yet still we see this U.S. military movement.
Aaron, we know that the U.S. has a continuing presence in Turkey. Is it your opinion that these troops are something other than that other ongoing continuing presence of U.S. troops?
Yeah, the continuing presence of U.S. troops in Turkey is very limited geographically to this one military base at Incirlik, which again is used to maintain the northern no-fly zone, and which, by the way, is managed by Dick Cheney's company, Halliburton. But these troops that have entered, at least some of them today, from the port of Iskenderun and the port of Marsin on the Mediterranean coast, they were sitting there with the specific purpose of fighting this war against Iraq. And in fact, when the Turkish parliament was voting on Saturday, and a lot of people, most observers, expected them to endorse this troop movement, they even started to unload them. But the government told them that, indeed, the parliament had voted no, and they had to turn back. But you have some very powerful statements now coming from the general who heads the Turkish army, and everyone here knows that the army has engineered a coup d'etat three times in Turkey since 1960, most recently in 1980, which was an incredibly bloody coup, and in 1998, the army was instrumental in overthrowing the government, not through a coup, through more nuanced means, of the last Islamic government here, of Mr. Erbakan and the Refah Party. So when the generals talk here, people listen. It's also interesting that this is happening just as the leader of the Turkish government, the civilian government, Mr. Erdogan, says that he supports the war, but said that he would wait until after the UN Security Council meets on March 14th, and that he was going back to his original pledge that he would only back a U.S. Troop deployment from Turkey with the support of the United Nations. So all of these things, Verna, are happening at the same time. Another thing that happened today, though, that is very significant, is that the Speaker of the Turkish Parliament, who had been opposing the war, announced that he now sees the war as inevitable, and like many politicians here, he would like to strike a deal with the United States. 95% of Turkish people, of course, oppose the war on Iraq and oppose Turkey's involvement in this war. 100,000 of them turned out over the weekend, and they came from all sectors of society. They were Islamic, they were unionists, they were students, every part of the society turning out on Saturday, and the parliament, by a narrow margin, voting no. Now the tide is turning. I can name three parliamentarians off the top of my head that I know that have changed their votes. So it's highly likely that the parliament would have changed its mind, but President Bush doesn't seem willing to wait for that. It's interesting to note that immediately after the Turkish parliament voted no, a team of the International Monetary Fund magically appeared in Turkey to talk about Turkey's budget and the fact that it owes the International Monetary Fund more than $100 billion, and Turkey's total debt is over $200 billion, which is actually bigger than the gross domestic product here. And so they have talked about what they call a peace tax, which is a gigantic new tax on homes and cars to pay for the lack of a U.S. aid, which is being made worse by this pressure from the IMF to further privatize the social security system and the health sector. So George Bush is using all the tools he has available to pressure Turkey, both the military and the economic pressures.
Aaron, how is this whole unloading or deploying of these troops to Turkish soil playing on Turkish television? What kind of reaction is there from the analysts and the political observers there in Ankara?
People are still trying to figure out exactly what is going on, because they know that troops are unloading, and they know that the general says that this is part of a previous agreement, which doesn't make any sense. So I'd say people are depressed, because people are used to seeing things happen this way in Turkey, with the generals making decisions instead of the politicians. And people had won a tremendous victory on Saturday with a no vote from the parliament. And now people that I've spoken to are just simply depressed.
Peace Watch correspondent Aaron Glantz speaking with us with that update from Ankara, Turkey. China is now prepared to veto any resolution submitted by the U.S. calling for force against Iraq, according to the Associated Press. China joins other permanent members, France and Russia, in calling for the U.S. and Britain to allow the weapons inspections to continue. Peace Watch spoke with former Texas governor candidate Raul Mahajan about the probability of a France or Russian veto of a second UN resolution.
If it is in fact true that the United States is planning to withdraw that resolution, then that's going to be perhaps the final blow to the to any kind of international respectability of the United States. It's already dealt itself a severe blow by showing very clearly that its drive to war in Iraq has nothing to do with disarmament and nothing to do with international law, and through its overt disrespect for other countries and democratic processes around the rest of the world.
How did Turkey's vote against allowing U.S. troops to launch attacks from its soil factor into the U.S.'s support at the U.N.?
Well, I think it was, in general, a very encouraging sign for most countries who don't want to support the United States but feel under tremendous amounts of pressure to do so. France, Germany, and Russia have made a joint statement, essentially, that they will not approve any resolution to authorize force. They've claimed that China is going along with them on this. Insiders say that likely talk about a Chinese or Russian veto if everything else worked out, if the United States was getting the 9 votes it needed, is unlikely, but a French veto is much more so. Spain and Bulgaria.
And of course, all it takes is one veto for this.
All it takes is one veto, but the United States had a plan essentially of saying, look, the majority of the Security Council is in favor of this, and you will just be an obstructionist if you veto against the will of the international community.
Spain and Bulgaria, you were about to say?
Bulgaria and Spain are both in the U.S. camp. Spain, because it has a very right-wing government, even though the people are so much against it that, in fact, roughly one out of every 15 Spaniards marched in protest on February 15th. Bulgaria, because along with most Eastern European countries, it is now very heavily dependent on NATO expansion and on the prospect of U.S. military aid and cooperation. Mexico, which is also highly dependent on the United States, is beginning to look firmer in its opposition. The African countries are subject to tremendous levers of coercion, partly because they all have major debt servicing problems, and the United States, of course, essentially has almost complete control over the IMF and World Bank. And the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which many of these countries are dependent on, also essentially requires that recipients of any kind of U.S. preferences not oppose the national security or foreign policy interests of the United States, which is a pretty big hammer that the United States is attempting to use on these countries.
So you're saying basically that the three African nations are likely to vote with the U.S.?
It's interesting that they're under tremendous pressure, and they have not yet caved.
And so the other nations on the U.N. Security Council?
The massive campaign of U.S. arm twisting has had, it seems, if you look on the surface at least, almost no effect as of yet. Whether that's actually true, what's going on beneath the surface is less clear. But, I mean, the big question for us is this talk of withdrawing a resolution just another feint. If Turkey doesn't allow the massive presence of U.S. troops, then the United States has to scramble desperately for a new military plan. While it's scrambling, that gives it perhaps more time to once again assemble its coercive measures at the U.N.
What if one or several of these nations decide to abstain? How would that help or hinder the U.S.'s in terms of furthering its agenda?
If enough of the other nations abstain, of course, then the resolution doesn't pass. It requires 9 affirmative votes. And right now, the United States looks at least nowhere near that.
How could the U.S. move ahead with its plans without first returning to the U.N.? How do you see that scenario playing out?
Well, it's an interesting question. It will be nothing like this will have ever happened before, where there's been such a long, pronounced and very public wrangling at the U.N., and then the United States says very openly we're simply going to ignore the will of the U.N. and go ahead. It can do this militarily. That's not a question. It can get away with at least part of it politically because it does have the overwhelming political, economic, and military power, but it will be certainly sowing the seeds for a partial destruction of the world order that was created after the Cold War that benefited the United States elite in numerous ways.
And what kind of split would that create in relations between the U.S. and the rest of the world?
Well, we're seeing the possibility of increasing rivalry between the United States and Europe. The whole wrangling over the war in Iraq is just one of the things. There's a lot of back and forth over trade policy as well, since the Bush administration is abandoning the free trade rhetoric of the Clinton administration and moving into a much more aggressively and overtly protectionist mode. China is the ultimate enemy, the one to be slowly strangled and squeezed over the space of the next several decades. So it is obviously relations there have the potential for serious deterioration. And finally, I think it's very clear that the Islamic nations are going to become much more significant breeding grounds for radical opposition to the United States. So I think that the war in Iraq is, among other things, the biggest test globally of the notion of democracy that has been seen yet. So we have the vast majority of people in almost every country in the world opposed. We still see a number of governments being strong-armed into support, so clearly in opposition to the will of their own people, and they are generally then hailed by the Bush administration and sometimes by the media in the United States as courageous for directly opposing the wills of their own people. George Bush has himself said the same thing, that if he were to be influenced by the will of the people as expressed in the protests on February 15th, then he wouldn't be doing his job as a democratically elected president. In a situation like this where you really have global public opinion matched directly with the power of the United States government, there is a real question what will be the result for even the concept of democracy. Will people around the world understand that the forms of democracy that create governments which are not accountable to them but are rather accountable to the United States government and the United States elite are fundamentally flawed and want to shift? That's a real possibility.
Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, and the forthcoming book, U.S. War on Iraq. Papal Representative Cardinal Pio Laghi met with President Bush at the White House yesterday to express the Pope's strong opposition to a U.S.-led war against Iraq. During an Ash Wednesday meeting at the Oval Office, Bush discounted the Vatican's plea, and he argued that foregoing a war would actually be immoral at this stage of the game. Meanwhile, multiracial interfaith church leaders are taking part in a prayer pilgrimage for peace to Baghdad. Peace Watch spoke earlier this week with the Reverend Walter Fauntroy, pastor at New Bethel Baptist Church in Washington and former U.S. congressman for the District of Columbia.
The thing that moved me was the movement of people all over the world in testament of the fact that this conflict is far more significant than, for example, the war in Vietnam, because people are marching in Australia, in Europe, in Southeast Asia, in North and South America, because they know no one will be able to escape the effects in an era when biological and chemical weapons of mass destruction are readily available and ready to be used all over the world. When the U.S. government told the American people that they have to go on orange alert and buy duct tape, I know now why people around the world are marching, because they know that what starts here could penetrate their own countries and their own streets and their own homes. This is a very critical moment in world history.
Reverend Fauntroy, President Bush and his administration, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and Donald Rumsfeld, have gone to great lengths to convince and persuade the world that this is an appropriate war for us to participate in, for that a preemptive strike is not only necessary but mandatory. Obviously, by your presence there in Baghdad, you're not convinced. What is it about the administration's argument that leaves you lacking?
Well, the first thing is that we're here in an 11th hour appeal to the leadership in both the United States and Iraq to recognize that war is no option in the 21st century when weapons of mass destruction are available, cheap, and will be used everywhere in the world. And accordingly, we are here in a last-hour effort to avert a war that could cause what Albert Einstein said to become a living reality. Albert Einstein said before he died and before he knew that we do not know what weapons will be used in World War III, but we do know that World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. That's how serious this is. But our question, what
what we're here is to appeal to the leadership here, as we have appealed to the leadership in America, not to launch this war. We've marched with our feet. We have petitioned by the hundreds of thousands in America. And people have marched by the millions around the world. Mm-hmm. And it has fallen on deaf ears.
What do you say to the critics that say, well, but you're there, you're being used as a pawn by Saddam Hussein's administration?
No, no, we have come with a very balanced message. We've come to say, quite frankly, at this moment, he is the only person in the world who can save us from the madness of a war that will cripple the lives of people who have sensed it and are marching in Southeast Asia, in the Philippines, in Australia, across Europe, in North and South America, and in Africa, because they know that the bombs dropped here will explode in terms of death and destruction in their neighborhood. We are spiritual leaders from every major religion in the world who live in the United States. We're Jews and Muslims and Christians and Sikhs and Buddhists and Hindus who recognize with Jews and Christians and Muslims that we're all the children of Abraham. And the consequence of what's going on, what threatens to go on here, is that millions of people all over the world will die. Now, having said that, and having we come there with that message and ask, as we've asked in Washington and in America, that the leaders understand that truth and act with courage to prevent that from happening. We have failed in America, but there's one hope, and the hope is that the leaders here will see that truth and act to take away from those who are mad the pretext for striking.
Reverend Fauntroy, will your delegation have an opportunity to meet with Saddam Hussein while you're there? I know that you met with the State Department before you left.
We met with his representative before we left, the U.N. ambassador from Iraq. We met with the State Department, and we met with the United Nations. And we came away with the feeling that all three entities are praying that we are successful. Secondly, we do intend to meet with the Foreign Secretary tomorrow, and possibly with President Hussein, who has a commitment at the Arab summit in Egypt. But we are hopeful we're going to be able to be here long enough to be able to meet with him, mm-hmm. to deliver a simple message. We want both sides to comply with the United Nations resolution. And we do so here because the U.S. government has indicated it is not going to abide by Resolution 1441. That no matter what the United Nations concludes about whether or not he has complied, they are going to strike. We're not going to waste our time there anymore. We're coming here and asking that they take from him the pretext by complying with the wishes of the United Nations and the people of the world who do not want biological and chemical weapons produced and used anywhere.
The Reverend Walter Fauntroy, president of the Black Leadership Conference, speaking with us from Baghdad. As the Bush administration moves this nation closer and closer to war, author and historian Howard Zinn offers this glimmer of hope.
As I write this, it looks like war. This, in spite of the obvious lack of enthusiasm in the country for war. The polls that register approve or disapprove can only count numbers. They cannot test the depth of feeling. And there are many signs that the support for war is shallow and shaky and ambivalent. This administration will not likely be stopped, though it knows its support is thin. In fact, that is undoubtedly why it is in such a hurry. It wants to go to war before the support gets any thinner. The assumption is that once the soldiers are in combat, the American people will unite behind the war. The television screens will show smart bombs exploding, and the Secretary of Defense will assure the American people that civilian casualties are being kept to a minimum. This is the way it has been, unity behind the president in time of war. But it may not be that way again. The anti-war movement will not likely surrender to the martial atmosphere. The hundreds of thousands who marched in Washington and San Francisco and New York and Boston, and in villages, towns, and cities all over the country, from Georgia to Montana, will not meekly withdraw. Unlike the shallow support for the war, the opposition to the war is deep and cannot be easily dislodged or frightened into silence. Indeed, the anti-war feelings are bound to become more intense. to the demand, support our GIs, the movement will be able to reply, yes, we support our GIs. We want them to live. We want them to be brought home. The government is not supporting them. It is sending them to die or to be wounded or to be poisoned by our own depleted uranium shells. No, our casualties may not be numerous, but every single one will be a waste of an important human life. We will insist that this government be held responsible for every death, every dismemberment, every case of sickness, every case of psychic trauma caused by the shock of war. And though the media will be blocked from access to the dead and wounded of Iraq, though the human tragedy unfolding in Iraq will be told in numbers and abstractions and not in the stories of real human beings, real children, real mothers and fathers, the movement will find a way to tell that story. And when it does, the American people, who can be cold to deaths on the other side, but who also wake up when the other side is suddenly seen as a man, a woman, a child just like us, well, yes, then the American people will respond. This is not a fantasy, not a vain hope. It happened in the Vietnam years. For a long time, what was being done to the peasants of Vietnam was concealed by statistics, the body count. Without bodies being shown, without faces being shown, without pain, fear, anguish shown. But then the stories began to come through. The story of the My Lai massacre, the stories told by returning GIs, of atrocities that they had participated in. And the pictures appeared. The little girl struck by napalm, running down the road, her skin shredding. The mothers holding their babies to them in their trenches as GIs poured rounds of bullets from automatic rifle into their bodies. When those stories began to come out, when the photos were seen, the American people could not fail to be moved. The war against communism was now seen as a war against poor peasants in a tiny country half the world away. At some point in this coming war, and no one can say when, the lies of the administration, oh, the death of this family was an accident, we apologize for the dismemberment of this child, this was an intelligence mistake, a radar malfunction, all of those lies will begin to come apart. How soon that will happen depends not only on the millions now, whether actively or silently in the anti-war movement, but also on the emergence of whistleblowers inside the establishment who begin to talk, of journalists who become tired of being manipulated by the government and begin to write the truth, and of dissident soldiers sick of a war that is not a war but a massacre. If Bush starts a war, he will be responsible for the lives lost, the children crippled, the terrorizing of millions of ordinary people, and all of us will be responsible for bringing that to a halt.
Howard Zinn, noted author of The People's History of the United States. Secretary of State Colin Powell's insistence on traditional diplomacy to disarm Iraq has run into a stone wall in the United Nations, and that has dealt a blow to his so-called moderate approach within the hardline Bush administration. With the UN Security Council due to take up a U.S., British, Spanish resolution next week to authorize force against Iraq, Powell was trying anew today to convince skeptical governments that only such a step, not more inspections, would do the job. The odds against him were long, and failure would confirm the view of Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld that turning to the United Nations would only produce a stalemate and delay disarming Iraq. Powell prevailed in his advice to President Bush, although the president questioned UN relevance as he kicked off the diplomatic campaign in a speech last September. Through it all, Powell has been the administration's point man, cajoling and appealing to reluctant allies like France and Germany, and laying out the U.S. case to the council with intelligence data that failed to persuade the skeptics. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.